My name is William Griggs, host of the Startup Slingshot TV, a show that delivers guidance from experienced entrepreneurs and business experts on how to dream, launch, and grow your business. If you're interested in learning how to make your product and your marketing plan the best it can be, you're going to want to stick around for this episode with Kevin Reddy. Kevin is a serial entrepreneur and author of the new book, Startup, An Insider's Guide to Launching and Running a Business. And on this episode, Kevin is going to help arm you with the knowledge you need to build and market your product successfully. Enjoy. All right, Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Really glad to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. And today, I teased it in the introduction, but I want you to help our audience successfully market their business. And to do this, I want you to tackle some of the misconceptions that most people have around marketing and product, and then lay out kind of a step-by-step plan that our viewers can take back to use to market their business. So let's get started. You ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so first off, why can't we just build a great product? Why isn't that enough? Why do we need to worry about marketing?
Well, I think when people start their businesses, they often think in a very product-centric way. I mean, that's why they're excited about doing a business in the first place, right? So we find people, no matter what their specialty is, almost the universal mistake that people make is that like say web developers, you know, the iconic .com sort of a startup, you get guys that get really excited about the technology and the idea that they can build something that people are going to use. And then they're focused when they do their startup on this idea. And they are looking out across this landscape of business and they can see off on the horizon that there's this finished product. And the big problem that I tend to find, and one of them, it's almost universal, is people see this world of startup land, and everything that's in it is the space between where they are now and the sort of finished product. And they can't see any of the other stuff that's around that. And they know intellectually that on the other side of building a product, there's this sort of thing where we're going to tell people about it. And then just on the other side of that, they're going to buy it. So building a product in reality is never enough. And I say that that's just the cost of admission. It's a ticket to play the game. And once you have a product, you have something that's got a great idea, it's got some real substance and quality to it, that the next day is when you really start your business, and that's when you're trying to connect it with an audience. And so you find lots of people that have products in the bucket, so to speak, and they hang their shingle out, and they're a little bit surprised that nobody comes and visits their lemonade stand, so to speak, because the real challenge in business these days, I believe, is the connection part, is not the building part.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. You talked about it. We got to have a good idea, and we're going to come to that, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later. But when should these people, when should the entrepreneurs, the viewers or the listeners of this program start thinking about how they're going to tell people about their product? Do they think about when they're actually building it? Do they think about as they're building it, before they're building it? Where does that fall in terms of the process of starting your startup?
Well, I think that the answer to all this wins is that is yes, 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 and yes. You need to be talking to people who you think are your customers before you build it. You need to be talking while you're building it so that that feedback is guiding you. You need to be talking to customers after it's built. That I think about the entrepreneur's conception of what he's doing and what he's going is something. It's a navigation system, and navigation systems are built on feedback. GPS or any other sort of guidance system from a technology standpoint is based on this idea of pinging, getting sort of data on where you're at, and then pinging again and getting it again and again and again and again. That's the only way to get to a real destination, a believable and viable destination that's not based on nine parts fantasy on your part. And communication serves many different objectives. We can break it down to two for the purposes of this conversation. And the first, for startups, the first thing about communication is to make sure you're building the right thing. And insofar as your network will connect you with the right people that can give you that sort of guidance. And then the second thing is to connect with the wider market to actually sell enough volume that it was worth your while. And they're very different types of activities, but they're both under the label of communication for this conversation.
Gotcha. Yeah, let's dig into those again. I'm making a note right now. But I think it's interesting how you compared it to, like you said, a GPS system where you're navigating the process from new product to getting someone to buy it. So you're interacting with the customers, like you said, as you come up with a new idea or who you think your customers are, through all the way as you continue to develop the product, finish the product, and sell it. So you're not just going out once you have the product, like you said, and trying to sell it. You're actually selling it along the way and getting feedback and implementing that feedback into your product. So that's an interesting way of thinking about it that our viewers and our listeners can take back as they build their own startup. So what about thinking about that good idea? You know, that's where we start with. What do we need to think about in terms of, you know, a lot of the entrepreneurs listening to this have lots of ideas. How can they start to filter their ideas and figure out which ones are good and which ones aren't good?
Well, that's where science becomes art, I think, in some sense, because every idea is, in essence, a hypothesis. So the seed that lies at the beginning, the birth of any startup, is a hypothesis that you say that group of people over there will. I think that they're going to pay this amount of money for this sort of a product, and if we build it, we can get a system of transactions going where we're going to make money. So, I think that any reasonable business in the startup realm is going to have to, you know, this question comes up a lot, actually. Where do you start? Do you start with a great idea, or just with the idea that you want to do a startup? And I think it happens both ways, but that whether you started with an idea or started with just the desire that you were going to build something, you have to get out there and communicate and validate your idea early before in order to know whether it's going to work or not. And actually, I just misspoke there because you won't know whether it's going to work or not until after you've run the distance of the track to find out. But you want to narrow the odds as well as you can and get them in your favor. So if you have 10 ideas, I mean, I do this exercise actually myself, you know, just start by having your list of ideas and write it down and carry it around with you. I mean, you just get a piece of paper, write your ideas down on it, fold it up and put it in your wallet. You'll find yourself through just your interactions with your you'll be in a conversation with a cup of coffee in your hand, and you'll realize, hey, you know what? Hold on a second. And you pull out this list and then just run it by and do that again and again and again. And you're going to find, in my experience, you'll find that you'll get consistency and reaction where the idea that you think is the best one, but people might say, oh, you know what? That's all right. And then you get down to, say, some other idea. And then you start finding a pattern where person after person starts reacting and they say, wow. I mean, are you going to build that? Can you build that? I would definitely use that. That's a great way to start.
Gotcha. So it starts by documenting your hypothesis, your assumptions that this is the problem someone has, and these are the people that have that problem, and this is how we're going to create the solution to that problem. And then we're going to start to test it, start off by conversations, like you said, and then maybe even build out something as we go along the process. What about
Sure.
even when we're filtering ideas in terms of thinking about how to structure our business or which business opportunities to go after in terms of, you know, barriers to entry or solving real problems? Are those things that we need to think about as we go forward, or is it more just have an idea and take it along the path?
Well, I mean, you can have an idea for building a new form of nuclear power plant, and it doesn't matter how great an idea it is, as the people in our audience will not have the expertise, the resources, the connections to do that.
If they do, they should email me. But
And
continue.
if you are such a person out there, then I give my sincere apologies for disrupting your afternoon by insulting you in that way. But in general, I mean, you're going to have to have a punch list of things that answer the question of why you're qualified to do it. Most of the time, you're going to need some sort of a geometric advantage over other folks in order to make a go of of any sort of startup idea. It could be that you've got, you know, a group of programmers that want to work with you. You have an expertise on a niche industry, and you identified based on that information that that there's a gap that you can fill with your idea. That you know, there needs to be a list of things, of reasons why you should be doing it, that you need to be aware of and be prepared to leverage, in addition to having a great idea, having identified a market that responded through your queries positively. And clearly, I mean, I think that that's a level of common sense that, that most people have, despite the fact that I frequently regret saying that something is common sense because I get proved wrong. I think entrepreneurs tend to gravitate towards those things that, that they know best, and that's a good thing.
Gotcha. It makes a lot of sense. So that, but then again, there are maybe either younger entrepreneurs out there that don't have a ton of skills or experience. They're just going after something that interests them, or they're people that want to change industries. But what I found interesting in your book was you talked about having, looking at your skills, kind of doing like a skills inventory, checking out your experience. Where do you have domain expertise, and where's your network lay, and then resources that you can tap into, and then overall arching knowledge of an industry or a problem set. Maybe you have it, maybe someone you know has a specific problem and you can partner with them to fix it. Is there anything else we need to think about with regards to coming up with the idea and filtering?
Well, another really important thing to look at is the geometry of the market that you're considering entering, because the geometry is really important, and sometimes people don't think about that. To say that when I say geometry, I have to paint a word picture for you, because geometry is inherently a visual thing to experience. But if you have an idea for, instance, maybe being a specialist to consult with something, and you say, well, I'm going to start a business and I'm going to consult, but realize that that has within it a certain geometry built in that says that every interaction that you have is going to be you and your expertise interacting in linear time with one other customer at most per unit time. So the consultant business model, for example, as if you're going to do this as a business, you know from the beginning that you're limited to a certain cap of amount of money you can make per unit time, and that's just your rate. And your rate can go up over time, but it has a practical limit. Whereas other things, well, if you say that I'm going to start a company and I'm going to hire a whole bunch of experts that I know, and I'm going to be sort of a broker for them and connect them, then you know that you've got a much higher slope on how you can scale your revenue. The geometry of these business ideas is it comes in other ways too. If you're talking about physical product, can you consistently get or build or otherwise acquire the thing that you're going to sell? Are the things that, what's the rate at which the market is going to consume that product? What's the rate at which you think you can connect with people that do that? That's a much wider discussion than we have time for here with me waving my hands. I would ask people to really look, get a whiteboard and fill up a whiteboard with everything that they can think of the geometry of those relationships through time and through whether you have hub and spoke sort of models, where you have linear models where you're just tapping out, whether you have geometric models that go sort of in a pattern that just expand exponentially over time. That you'd be surprised how many people don't really realize the implications of those very early structural details of their startups.
Yeah, and though we don't have time to get into that, that gets the viewers, the listeners' minds just turning. So as they think about their idea, like you said, how a traditional consultancy works with one person versus multiple people. What about when they're approaching a market? I know in your book you talk a little bit about the niche approach. Can you share a little bit with that about that with our audience?
Well, one of the tried and true ways of making money in the world when you're new is to find a spin, it's a niche approach where you can see that there's consumer activity in the market, but a very particular subset of that need isn't being met. And then in recognizing that and building a product to target that, you solve a lot of your problems. One, not the least of which is the communication burden once you've got a product released. Because if you can identify and communicate with a very specific subset of an existing market, then you've got a better spiel, a better reason why these people would want to do business with you if you're solving a subset of a problem. That's a great way to get started in markets, and I advocate that in many cases. But you'll find some people that just have the idea that they built something better, and they'll, as I talk about in the book, I mean, sometimes when you have more resources, when you have a VC-backed company, and you are really scaling out and you're doing something, that there's nothing less is going to settle, going to get you the VC backing than a really convincing story about how you're not going to attack a niche. You're going to go right up to the castle gate and you're going to knock it down. These things come in all flavors, but typically for people that are on the smaller side, I advocate the niche approach, because a lot of times you see people with a great idea, and the power of their imagination can play that idea out in such a way that they'll construct a story for themselves that says, you know what, this idea is so superior to what's out there that when I build this and go out, that it's going to turn this industry on its head upside down, because it's cheaper, it's better, it's all these other things. And that's typically what I call entrepreneurial foolishness. That's a sort of energy and enthusiasm that we all need, and it can power us to be really excited, but it needs to be tempered with some common sense to say, you know, am I really going to be able to execute what I call a build, tell, sell business model? I'm going to build it, I'm going to tell people about it, and they're going to buy it. And that's when you start out, the foolish enthusiasm tends to have that simple geometry. It's mostly build, a little bit of tell, and then a lot of sell on the other side of that. The real ratio here, I think, is a little bit of build, and then a little bit of change, a little bit more build, a little bit of change, a little bit more, and then a whole lot of tell with only a little bit of sell for a while, and then the sell will increase over time thereafter. But if I think people that got really excited about a business idea, if they really saw that geometry about how it's going to play out in front of them, a lot fewer people would probably do startups. So it's that foolish enthusiasm that we really need as the fuel to get us through it. But niche markets are a great way to start.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of people in the audience now, and I know a handful of them that could say, hey, we tried to hit the ball over the fence the first time with this huge, big approach. Second go around, we're taking the niche approach. Instead of saying, I don't know, a random example that comes to mind, instead of saying we're going to provide interactive and website strategy and website development and mobile apps to everyone, we're only going to do website development for this specific niche of a customer's. Trial Injury Lawyers, there's a firm in Nashville that does it just for trial injury lawyers. And that's kind of the quintessential niche approach right there, to saying, hey, now we know exactly who to sell to. We know exactly where to find them. We know if we can land a couple of them, they're going to help us land some more. We're going to build up this repertoire of actual applicable finished products that we can use to sell future clients in addition to that.
And oftentimes that has much less to do about what you're capable of delivering and what you're capable of you know, providing service-wise or product-wise, and everything to do about the geometry of the communication burden that you have once you decide what you're doing.
Gotcha, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. That's an interesting, again, way to think about it, using geometry and the differences between the different models. But what about, I don't know if you'll know this off the top of your head, but there was a section in your marketing chapter called Will You Be a Whale or an Eskimo? Do you remember that section?
Sure.
Could you talk a little bit about that one?
Well, that's back to the fundamental geometry of a business model. And, you know, if we take a look at the classic image of the Eskimo group if you've watched National Geographic specials when you were a kid, you have this image, like if you're me, you have an image in your head of that they eat whale. And what that means is that they really need to get one big transaction with their environment every year, and then everybody's fine, everybody's great. As opposed to the whales themselves, that when they're feeding themselves and going through the ocean, they're filtering thousands and thousands, if not millions of gallons of water, and filtering out tens of thousands of small shrimp, and they're catching them in mass. So this metaphor of Eskimos versus whales is really applicable to businesses. I know some people will do sort of enterprise software. I mean, it was much bigger in the 90s than it is now, but people that are doing, they're targeting big business, and they really just need to get one or two contracts, and then they know that they're good, and that they're going to have good cash flow and everything else. A lot of risk associated with that. Whereas you know, the other side of the coin is to say, you know, we're going to produce something that's widely applicable to lots of people, and I'd rather have 5,000 transactions a month that are small dollar value as opposed to one transaction a year, which is a large dollar value. I think the smaller approach, at least to my taste and my sensibility, is tends to be better often. Depends on the idea, of course, because it's easier to validate your market when you have lots of small transactions. You can get out small and sort of experiment your way into figuring whether it'll scale. On the enterprise side, if you're trying to do one big transaction, you won't know for quite a while whether that works or not, and whether you're gonna be able to get someone to sign a check. Because doing research with big companies is fraught with risk, because if you're trying to validate a big company sale idea and you're not already an insider and you don't already know from an insider's viewpoint that things are going to really hit a real pain point, it's hard to validate, because people will tell you a lot of stuff that doesn't bear out in reality. It's hard to get a lot of data points for that.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. That those are good things to think about when the viewers or the listeners here are trying to decide which path to take. Are they going to be the whale, or are they going to be the Eskimo? What about your section in the marketing chapter around, or that's titled "The Internet Is Not Magic"? Can you share with our viewers a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we're back to geometry. There's nothing quite. I mean, I have been in the internet and doing internet business since the mid 90s. I guess I remember thinking in 1996 or 97 that I felt this deep sense of regret that I didn't get into the internet before it blew up and got big. I thought, oh man, I should have gotten in and built some sort of business. Because at that point, we had no idea. I don't think anybody had any idea how important it was going to be. But in terms of, I've gone off on such a tangent that I forgot the thrust of your question.
Yeah, so all about the internet and how it's not magical.
And the geometry there and why it isn't magic is that if you feel now what I felt then and have felt all every time since, you know that if you put something online, that the geometry is that point in space where you have your business in some sense is tangential to most everybody in the world that has an internet connection. You can feel that sort of electric potential that says, wow, if I build this and people anywhere in the world are right there. They could. This is in everybody's living room. It's in everybody's office. It's in everyone's phone, their laptop. Again, we get down to the burden of communication. Easy to build, hard to communicate. And the communication is about getting a good message, but more importantly, it's about getting people to pay attention to you, to listen, to process with their brains, their eyes, and their ears what you're saying. And that's the big challenge. And the geometry becomes a challenge there, because most attempts to do that, people will fail. And so the burden of communication and the difficulty of getting people's attention in a world that's saturated with messages means that the internet isn't magic, that you have to couple a good product with a good message with a really excellent and well thought out and probably well financed plan to connect the geometry.
Talk about the difference between positional and structural differentiation and how that's going to help us when we're positioning our business and how it's going to help us cut through the clutter.
So everyone since really, I guess, the 50s and 60s, when we had an explosion of products in the United States, we've all grown up. Even if you're not a business person, you understand the idea intuitively of building a better mousetrap. And that's just super common sense, right? I mean, if you go to lots of books about the subject, if you get an MBA, you're going to get hammered a lot about, you know, that you need to have a differentiated product. And I agree to a point that you do need a differentiated product. It's one of the most widely accepted things in the world of business. In my experience, I've built products that were differentiated, especially in the online world, being differentiated. doesn't seem to matter as much. That when like a real estate-based business that I've been working with for the past 4 years, in our initial, as we were building out and positioning ourselves, we spent a lot of time differentiating who we are, why you should shop with us, and all these other things. But it turns out not to matter very much to the customer. That, as opposed to building a better mousetrap, you can another alternative way of actually and doing what we did is to think about how we structurally put ourselves where customers need our service. And just a simple fact that we're structurally present and we're there as an option at the time of a transaction makes us successful, as opposed to having differentiated our messaging and saying, we're better because of A, B, and C. In order for that to work, people have to engage with you to a greater depth than they actually do online in many, many cases. In the cases of a real estate search, for instance, we based our strategy around the idea that we understood the geometry of our market. We're in rental real estate, and so we would know that of the 80 million households in the United States that are actually renting places to live, they tend to live in the same place for 18 months and then move. So 80 million households, beginning of our geometry, and then every 18 months they go from being not a possible customer to they're a possible customer for 2 weeks while they're searching, and then they're not again. So out across the wide internet, we can't identify which people are about to move and just market to them. We're going to have to find a better way to do that, and Google AdWords is great for that. So our structural answer to being people's shopping destination for rental property was to this following thesis statement. 80 million households, they're going to move once every 18 months. When that happens, a great proportion of them are going to reflexively go to Google, and they're going to type in the search. They're going to hit enter, and they'll be presented with a list of options at the end of that. We will always be on the screen when they do that search. So then the purpose of our business and the way that we would be successful wasn't that we had differentiated, although we did. It wasn't that we were pretty and doing all this stuff, although we were. It was the fact that we were able to execute a strategy which looked at the geometry of the market and structurally put us there every time one of those potential transactions happened. And when I say every time, of course, we weren't there every time, but we were there enough of the time to where we grew a thriving business. We're a local Austin company. We were acquired by a much bigger company. And in the immediate period of time following that acquisition, we returned them many times their purchase and become kind of heroes for them. But that wasn't because of the traditional idea of differentiation. It was structural in nature.
Gotcha.
Another example, which is real brief on that, is if you're selling pizza, how are you going to sell pizza better than other people? I mean, look, it might be the most heavily marketed product, individual like product besides, I don't know, automobiles in the United States. I mean, you've got frozen pizza. You've got if you go to the pizza, there's a whole pizza aisle at the grocery store. I mean, it's everywhere there. There's pizza restaurants. There's delivery. There's TV shows telling you how to make it for yourself if you wanted to do that. So if you want to sell pizza, a great way to ensure that you sell a lot of it at a great price would be to open up a pizza restaurant in an airport. So you have an audience that structurally, if they want pizza, they're there, and you're just simply in front of them. It's a transaction waiting to happen again and again and again, thousands of times a day. Just put yourself in that place. Doesn't matter whether you're cheaper, because you can be more expensive at an airport. Doesn't matter whether you're better or not. It just if they know what the product category is, so they'll transact with you if they're hungry and they want pizza. So you can wipe away a lot of the challenges of traditional differentiation by structurally approaching it that way.
Gotcha. So it comes into like location, like you said, with the pizza salespeople. It comes into partnerships or finding complementary businesses that you can scratch each other's back. So structurally, you're there, like you said, when people need your service. So they're not going to just necessarily find you and research all about how you're different. Whereas if they're ready to make a decision, you just got to be where they are when they're ready to make that decision.
And it varies by product category because you have high thought and low thought purchases. So this really works for numerous low thought interactions. So that wouldn't work, for example, with a car purchase. Because people are going to research it, they're going to test drive, they're going to, they're going to do. So this is really good for the whale approach.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So let's do one last question, then we'll wrap it up. So let's talk a little bit about the if you can't measure it, you can't control it section of the marketing chapter.
Well, yeah, that's something that does come right out of the MBA textbook and something that I agree with. And if you're going to be trying to do a communications campaign that is going to effectively communicate your message, you're going to be spending money on that. And we know that you never want to spend money on something that you don't get feedback from, because at least not in the beginning, because you've only got a certain amount of gasoline in the tank, and you got to make sure you get all the full distance to your destination. So, if you're doing an online business or you're doing an offline business, you just need to make sure that when you spend advertising dollars, that you find ways to track what happens with that. That's just fundamental, because you have to figure out what works and what doesn't. Leverage the things that work, drop quickly the things that don't work. That's just key to it. So, there have been times in my career, really early on, when I didn't do that and found myself just spending a lot of energy, a lot of money, what for me at the time was a lot of money, communicating in ways that ended up not being effective, and really regretting it. And starting out small and doing that, as I did, it was one of the most valuable lessons I learned. And that was and that I recommend to other people, if you got kids and you want them to be entrepreneurs, or you're young yourself, to, when you're young and when you're early 20s, it's really the time to jump out and to do a business, and to jump in with, as my granddad used to say, jump in with all 4 feet and just go for it, in the sense that you don't have far to fall. And if you've got these sort of lessons that we're talking about in this conversation, and many, many more, are really best learned by doing and seeing and feeling, as opposed to reading about it in a book or other things that, realizing the importance of having feedback from your marketing is something that you learn really quickly. And it would get burned into your psyche once you found that you spent hundreds of dollars of your own real money that you could have used for something else, like having fun or whatever else, if you're a young person trying to market, and you say, wow, you know what? I really have to measure how this works. Those lessons are best learned by doing, as opposed to just hearing someone like me talk about it, or reading a book, or watching this. So I encourage people. It's one thing I'm trying to sneak into the end of our conversation here, is that I recommend that people just jump out and do it when they're young, or encourage their kids to do that. It's a bit harder once you have a family and everything to jump in.
Right, it makes a lot of sense. That's the point. A lot of our interviewees have driven home the point of getting started and doing it, and the fact that you'll learn a lot from it. And the earlier the better, it seems, is the trend here. Let's talk a little bit more about how you can track these things. It seems like, off the top of my head, if you're using Google AdWords, like you're saying, you can track the clicks, you can track the purchases, you can see the conversion ratio or conversion rate. You can also do phone numbers on advertisements to track your advertising, coupons or coupon codes. Are there any other ways that they can think about, if they're starting to advertise their business, how they can actually begin to track what they're doing?
Yeah, there are lots of resources for this online. It just becomes a part of doing business. But you'll notice in my book that I've tended to not get into depth on things like that. But there's so many tools that are available, and if we were to describe in any detail specific mechanisms, they'd probably be changed within a year from now. Some of the standbys for that are using Google Analytics. You'd be surprised how cheap it is to get a dedicated phone number, even a local dial phone number. So if you're going to put an advertisement out on the radio, just find someone to give you a local dial number. It'll cost, I mean, when we buy in bulk, less than $20 a month to get a dedicated number that'll just ring to your phone. But you'll be able to track the stat and say, well, the 555 number only went out in that ad, and we got 3 calls, and we paid $1,000 for the ad. That's, branding effects aside, which you get branding effects from everything you do, we got 3 transactions for $1,000. That probably isn't, since we're selling lemonade and we make 50 cents a cup, it's probably not going to be a great investment. That's an example. And the level of online tools for measuring is just innumerable. And I recommend starting with AdWords, new Facebook ads. Make sure to put tags on the keywords so that you know what's coming in as clicks to your site, and then use Google Analytics. It takes 10 minutes to set up, and you can track that stuff pretty well.
Yeah, that'll give our viewers and our listeners a good step in the right direction. Have we missed anything? I'm sure we have. What's one thing that you'd like to drive home to our viewers and listeners right now before we log off?
I was just in New York a couple weeks ago for Tech Day, and I had the privilege of being a judge for that. It's not a competition per se, but there's 160 startups in all grown in New York City, and I do there what I've done at South by Southwest and other things, where I make it a point to go through every one of the startups that I can get to and just talk to them one after another and say, you know, I'll deliberately produce the ideal consumer interaction for them. But I'll stand square shoulders to them, I'll look them in the eye, and I'll ask them, what do you do? And that almost never happens in reality. You got to fight to get someone to give you even the corner of their attention. But, you know, doing that for these startups, creating the ideal consumer interaction, look at them, what do you do? And you'd be surprised how many, the great percentage of them, that fail to do what they need to do in that at that point in time. And that's to, you know, start at a very high altitude and say, hey, this is the field we're in. We handle this part of this field. We provide this value, and we do this and this and this and this to produce value for our customers' lives, where they don't just, you know, come to be our customers. They love us, and they keep coming back and back. And to make the customer, me in this case, feel like I'm not going to do them a favor by transacting with them. What they need to do with that interaction is to make me reach out and grab their collar and hold them and say, how do I get this product? I have to have it right now, ideally, right?
Right.
And they have to at least try to induce that that reaction in me. And one of the litmus tests is I was working through this with these advertisers and these startups, was that here's a litmus test for you. I need to understand what you've done, understand why I would choose you for it. And as I walk away from this interaction in 10 minutes, I have to still remember who you are, what you do, and why I care in 10 minutes. In most cases, if you haven't done that communication right, I won't have that with me 10 seconds after I walk away, because I'm seeing other people, or I mean, I'm just doing other things. I'm talking to another company. That, you know, poorly formatted messages don't even last through our short-term memory for even a few minutes. But beyond 10 minutes, the litmus test carries on to say, if I interact with you now, what you tell me, I need to remember it a day from now. 24 hours from now, I need to be able to say, yeah, okay, the business was called this, they're on this website, they did this, I want them because of this. And the final litmus test on that is that their messaging needs to be so good for me that I can communicate it to another human being with fidelity a day later or a week later. Gotcha. And almost nobody did that. Some people did, notably. As we're finishing up here, I would say that the strategy behind this is that you get someone, and you touched on this earlier, they say, well, we do this and we do that and we do this other thing and we do this 40 different things. We're a social network that provides positional information for dining and entertainment in metropolitan areas, and we have real-time this and real-time that and all that. It's like, I have no idea what you just said. I understood every single word, but I don't know what you do. That every business needs to come up with 4 or 5 word description that says, in very concise terms, what it is they do. To structure all their communication around that very, very small amount of attention that they're going to get from customers in the real world, and what message to put in there. And that's some very short description. And an example of this, and do we have a moment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Chip and Dan Heath in the book Made to Stick, which is a great book I recommend people read, they talk about a hypothetical sort of meeting that happens in Hollywood. And some people are selling the movie Speed. And it's just some sort of a producer, and he said, you know, we're going to do this movie. And okay, here's a scenario. We've got a bus. It's full of people. It's rocketing down the streets of LA, and it's got a bomb on it. A terrorist had put it there, and they can't slow down because if they slow down, the bomb is going to go off. But they got to stay on highways, and they're avoiding traffic lights and everything else. A cop, we think we're going to Keanu Reeves, he's going to sneak onto the bus, and we're going to get another lady, and they're going to try to. It's like da 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 da, boom. It's like really all this detail. Again, it's a poorly structured sort of message. You're going to tell someone this stuff, they're not going to remember it a day later. And the way Chip and Dan said, you know, it's like, no, not all the detail. Just say it's Die Hard on a bus. And will it then pass the test? Will someone remember it in 10 minutes? Probably. In a day? Probably. After a day, will they be able to describe it to someone else with fidelity? Almost certainly. That if you save people the effort of trying to find a way to hold on to all this data by giving them a handle to hold on to, then you do yourself and your business a great favor, and you'll have to do that to survive.
Gotcha. Clear and concise communications. It sounds like this is maybe the value proposition that you're building all your other communications around, but you're also saying as you go through the build, tell, sell, you might be adapting this, you might be changing this to what resonates.
Always changing stuff around a little bit here and there.
And then the final point, could you reemphasize those 3 points about what people should be able to answer? So it's why choose you, what you do.
Yeah, well, so you're always answering the question, why you? And you'd be surprised how many people don't even know how to explain that to themselves, let alone to customers. So why you? And when you have an interaction with a customer, and there are different categories of interactions, like there's display advertising and all that. This doesn't qualify. This sort of litmus test doesn't qualify for that because those touches are too light. But if you ever find yourself in the fortunate position of being in front of a customer, they have to remember you 10 minutes later. They got to remember you a day later. And they have to be able to take that explanation the day later or a week later and communicate it with fidelity to another human being. And if we do have 1 second, I'll expound on that a little
Yeah, go
more.
ahead.
And this is the way that in my mentoring of startups, this is a story that I tell that I believe in quite strongly. Just say, here's a scenario. This is you. You're going to be going on vacation tomorrow, and you're going to South America. You're going to stay there for a month. And so you're preparing right now. This is an allegory for what we do with our businesses. But you are preparing to go, and you've got all your stuff. You've got this. You can imagine your bedroom floor. Just imagine you've got this collection of things that you're going to take because you're going to be gone for a whole month, and you're going to be in another country. You've got, you know, the Advil. You've got your toothbrush. You've got your all your bathroom items like nausea medication, and you've got jeans, and you've got shirts, and you've got pants, and you've got extra underwear. You've got your camera battery. Is that and you got wait? We got to take an umbrella because I hear it rains a lot down there, and I don't know if they even we're going to take an umbrella. All this stuff, there's hundreds of items all over the floor of your living room, and you're getting ready to go tomorrow. You know instinctively that in order to take all this stuff, which is vital, with you, you can't just take it. What do you have to do with it? You have to take it, you got to gather it up, and you have to put it inside something that has a handle on it. Because you're going to have to pick that up, and you're going to have to carry it with you. And you know at the airport tomorrow, you're going to have to hand it to another human being. And he's going to have to be able to carry it. He's going to have to be able to walk away from you with that thing using the handle that you provided. And that guy's going to have to handle it to somebody else. And they're going to have to be able to take it because of the handle you provided. So if you have an explanation of your business that says, we do A, B, and C, and D, and E, and because we do E, we do F, G, H, and Z, and double Z, and everything else, and dot, 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 you get so excited about your explanation. And people do this because they love it, they know their stuff. They have the curse of the expert because they all they do with their business day in and day out. And they hit the ground running with an explanation, say, well, you're going to want to choose us for this because we da 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 da. It blows people's minds. Their hair will stand up like this on end. They'll just be backing up away from you because you're not communicating effectively. Make it easy for them by structuring a message that they can hold in their hands, something that has a handle on it. I was talking with some financial products guys at this show, and they said, well, we do this and this and this, and we do da 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 da, and I kind of stepped back and said, well, it sounds like your service magic for IRA accounts. And they said, yeah. But, oh, okay. Like if we had started with that, assuming that I know what service magic is, then I would immediately know what it was that they were doing. Yeah, I recommend that people spend what may seem to be a disproportionately large amount of time thinking about how they condense a very complex message down into something that will resonate with their audience.
Yeah, that's a great way to wrap up. If people are interested in your book or interested in finding out more information about with you or connecting with you, how can they find you online?
KevinReady.com. That's Kevin, R-E-A-D-Y.com.
Simple enough. So to any of the viewers out there that are watching, if you know someone who's looking to start a business, you know someone who's working on a startup, Kevin and I want you to take the link and your URL, you're going to copy it, you're going to email it. We're going to pause right here. We're going to wait for you as you do that, and we'll just be waiting right here. These are great people. I know they're doing it right now. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And then they're going to send it to everybody they know, and they're going to look really smart. Their friends are going to love them. And then we're going to be on the internet, and random people are going to be watching us. It's going to be awesome. So
hold on, man. You're going to take my server offline. What are you doing?
Oh, man. Yeah, well, we'll take down YouTube with all these views. So I appreciate you for watching, for listening. I appreciate you for sharing this. Kevin, I appreciate you for coming on and sharing all this information. And I encourage all the people to check out your website, check out the book, and buy it if they're interested.
One more thing. I'm also a contributor for Forbes. So if you go on the Forbes.com and look for Kevin Ready, you'll see I have a stream of articles out there every week.
Nice, nice. All right. There's one more thing that you have to do. But first thing you do is share the link. Second thing you do is check him out, KevinReady.com. And the third thing you do is hop over to Forbes.com and check out all the great stuff he's contributing there. So again, thanks for y'all. Thanks to all y'all for watching. And thanks for you for coming on, Kevin.
Thanks. Pleasure.